Sunday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast, long overdue NBA Reddit mailbag. Ready to get started here. Sponsored today by Blinds.com, a new sponsor. Go to Blinds.com and use promo code CAPSPACE to get 20% off some new blinds to upgrade any room, your entire house, whatever you want to do at Blinds.com. And then Indochino, visit Indochino.com and enter promo code CAPSPACE at checkout to get any premium Indochino suit for just $389. All right, where are we going to start, Danny?
Lots of good questions this time. We'll start with one that I just enjoy this as a topic area. It's from Kemba17. In the NFL, free agency happens before the draft. Obviously, this is a little unrealistic for the NBA with things like Summer League, but what would change about how teams approach the draft and free agency if free agency came before the draft? The most interesting thing that it would do is it would really sometimes constrain teams in terms of needs. So you could have a circumstance where a team has $20 million in cap space, and in the current system, the world is their oyster, but in that sort of system, they would probably have already spent that $20 million, and maybe what they need is a point guard, so they might move up or down in the draft a little bit to find the right person.
I would not be in favor of this. I do have an executive I talked to whose opinion I respect, who has suggested it to me, and I actually wrote about the possibility when I did a big piece at the D-League Showcase back when I still actually wrote last year, talking about some potential changes under the new CBA. The big argument by this executive was it would enable more trades to happen during the draft, because as it stands now, a lot of times some of these trades, nobody really has cap space, and there are a lot of expiring contracts that are still technically on your books at the time of the draft. And so the trade could be agreed to, but it can't actually be consummated until after the moratorium. Now, it seems like we had plenty of draft trades and we're doing just fine by agreeing to the trades and actually executing them after the moratorium is over. That doesn't strike me as a big impediment. The big reason why a lot of people who work in the league are really against this is there really would be no way that it wouldn't just eat into everyone's vacation. I mean, all these guys bust their asses, and some women as well, who works in basketball ops. And your vacation in the NBA really is like late July until maybe like beginning of September is when you can actually get some time off. And free agency really couldn't be any earlier than it is, with the finals potentially ending, you know, June 19th last year. So it's hard to have free agency any earlier than 12 days after that. And then if you had the draft also, and you got it, your draft prep would be interrupted by having to do all the free agency stuff. And you really probably couldn't have the draft until maybe like July 20th or something, or maybe like July 14th. So that would make things a lot more chaotic there. And then you'd have Summer League as well. Summer League probably wouldn't be over until like mid-August. And now really most teams have guys come in, a lot of them, I mean, this isn't mandatory, but a lot of teams will do it starting like in September to really play pickup and ramp up to get into shape for training camp. So I think practically it wouldn't really work. I would be for just totally adjusting the schedule and moving, still having the same off season, but basically just moving everything back a month and have like the finals be in July, especially because there's even less competition at that point, more NBA playoffs without other competition. You wouldn't be competing as much with hockey, wouldn't be competing as much with the NCAA tournament. But I've gone on long enough here. I wouldn't be in favor. I guess the other thing too is just that I think it's maybe, do you think it's harder to identify who you might get in free agency or harder to identify who you might get in the draft? I think probably the latter.
Probably the latter, especially with the prevalence of pseudo tampering. And there are certain teams that can have a pretty good idea of not only a player, but their price. So I feel like it's a little bit easier to go that direction.
So we have a couple of questions here on extensions for that star-crossed 2014 class due to their injuries. But first, this from Blinds.com, a new sponsor. If you want more privacy, maybe you just want a few more hours of darkness in the morning, no matter what your reasoning is, you have to take out a second mortgage to get brand new custom blinds from Blinds.com. There are a lot of bad blinds out there. I've experienced a lot of them. We have actually some really bad ones in our house right now. We're renting, so I haven't actually been able to take advantage of Blinds.com yet, but I'm actually looking into using them for a rental property that I have, that I own. And like so many of our sponsors, it's just a better way to do something that you traditionally had to, right? You've got so many options at your fingertips with Blinds.com. You can hop on the phone with an expert. You can see some instructional videos. They'll walk you through the measuring installation process every step of the way. It makes a lot more sense than trying to get them at the store. They also have a 100% satisfaction guarantee, so if you make a mistake measuring your blinds, picking your color, anything at all, they'll remake your blinds for you for free. If you want samples, they're free. The shipping, of course, is free. And you can't go wrong with made-to-order custom blinds from Blinds.com. So the way to get started with them, go to Blinds.com and use promo code CAPSPACE. That will get you 20% off your order. And of course, let them know that you came from us. That's Blinds.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember, of course, since we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program. Rules and restrictions may apply. See Blinds.com for details. All right, where are we going to go next here?
So since you teased the extension stuff, I feel like we might as well talk about it. There are kind of two different questions. I think we can kind of talk about them at the same time. Or do you want to do them separately?
Well, yeah, let's do the one from Kat Gonna Get That Yarn, spelled K-A-T.
I think Zach Harper has rights on that, but full credit to everybody. Embiid, Parker, and Levine all are going to be injured when they're eligible for rookie extensions this summer, and Levine and Parker will both still be injured when the extension deadline passes. They all have different levels of re-injury concern and different levels of upside, but how would you handle their respective contracts?
Levine and Parker, you're giving me a huge discount, or we'll just see how you look next year and go into restricted free agency. I think even though there's a risk with Parker, especially, that maybe he looks great, and although this is the second one now, so that either of them could look great, and then you have matching rights on them, of course. There's some worry that they could do the Gordon Hayward and get a 3+1, but you also could just offer them a good contract as a free agent, knowing that you have them restricted. You could still offer them a 5-year deal. In fact, that would be helpful for the Wolves if they wanted to offer Levine a 5-year deal, because you can only offer a 5-year deal for the max in an extension, and then they can only have one designated rookie that they can sign. So, and that's going to be reserved for either Wiggins or Towns. So makes more sense to let Levine get to free agency. Worst case scenario, absolute worst case scenario, he refuses to sign your offer and signs like a 2+1 for more money than you're willing to pay elsewhere. But if he's that good to garner that kind of an offer, that's kind of a good problem, and you can always pay him enough so that it's worth it for him to not do that. Same thing, I think, with Parker. Embiid, it's a different situation. His cap hold, as well as Parker's, are both pretty high. That's the other advantage too of Levine, is his cap hold is lower. So Embiid, he's different to me, even though you can look at him as a big injury risk. He hasn't had any problems with the foot, at least. The knee, of course, is a concern, especially given that he injured it playing essentially with kid gloves this year, or being handled with kid gloves this year, only playing 31 games, not playing back-to-backs, etc. So there's definitely a concern that he's injured. You don't save any money by not maxing him out, but he's proven that he can play at almost the level of a max player now, you know, not even considering that he can improve. So I think with him, it wouldn't shock me if he just gets the max anyway, especially because his cap hold, they'd only be saving like $6 million by not maxing him. But it also wouldn't shock me if they say, hey, you're going to have to stay healthy through another season, and then, you know, we can always just give you a 5-year max deal. Like, this isn't the case before. The whole reason that some of those 2+1s, there was a fear for it, was everyone knew the cap was going up. Now it's supposed to be pretty flat. So it would be shocking to me if anyone got offered a 5-year deal at close to the max and turned it down once they actually are a restricted free agent.
I think a lot about players like Chris Middleton and Evan Fournier, who, you know, were going into restricted free agency and took less money than we expected, and they were weeks or even days away from getting those offer sheets than what they ended up doing. So there is certainly some risk aversion there from various capacities, and I think that teams can use that to their advantage. You hit on a big point, which is the idea of what does a two plus one risk in those circumstances? And for Parker and Levine, it might be a little bit different. But the other thing that runs in favor of Joel Embiid in that way is that you could just do what the Bulls did with Jimmy Butler and make him a max qualifying offer if you wanted to.
That's right. Yeah, you could do the max qualifying offer.
And take that off the table.
Yeah. And then you'd be looking at a three plus. For those who forget, by the way, the max qualifying offer, it is a 5-year deal for the maximum that you can pay, maximum possible raises. And then no other team can sign him to an offer sheet unless it's at least 3 guaranteed years. So that takes the 2+1 off the table. Now, the max qualifying offer does cause his capital to shoot up to the max. That's one thing that they actually made clear in this CBA, which was a little nebulous in the last one. But that's a great point, really, that is still available for teams.
It is. And so I would approach it from kind of a position of power in that sense. You offer them a significant discount and you say, hey, we'd love to do this with you, especially in that way with Levine and Parker, because you might want 5 years of Embiid, as crazy as that sounds, just because of how crazy good he's been. But yeah, I think that's the way that you play it out with those guys. And if they take it, great. If they don't take it, you know, you put it at a reasonable number and then be ready to pony up the next year. Like, you are taking a risk, but I think that's totally fair for the course, especially with Parker's injury history.
Yeah, and maybe what could happen with Embiid too is that they could give him the max and then like the last 2 years would have some partial non-guarantees on him.
Or kind of like the Harden deal. Like, if you remember Harden's extension, the final year on that was less than half guaranteed originally, and then they had escalators in there, which I wish that they could kind of make that go both directions, but hey, I think that's fair in this case.
All right, let's move on here. This is somewhat similar from pick protection. For the members of the 2014 draft class, Wiggins, we talked about Levine, Embiid, and Jabari. So Wiggins, Gordon, Smart, and Randall. Who gets a max or close to max extension this summer? Smart will not. Randall will not. Wiggins probably will, because this is probably going to be the Wolves' last chance to really use cap space is this summer with all the extensions that they have coming up. And so that leaves Aaron Gordon, and he's a very interesting one. I think a lot depends on how he plays the rest of this season, now back at what had always should have been his natural position of power forward.
To me, Wiggins is the only one that I feel confident is going to be a yes, that he'll get the max or close to it. As you said, the incentives are a little different. We'll talk about that a little bit later. I also, my feeling is that Embiid is going to get a lucrative deal and they're just going to get it done. It's the difference between the management regimes. I just think they're going to do that, because considering how disappointing this year is going to turn out, unless Sarge just blows up to just get something on there to say, hey, look, you know, we'll do it that way. It actually crazily could depend also on how their draft picks do in summer league. I could even see it being that way. Like, do they need to turn a narrative or not? But I would say those are the only two where it'd be seriously considered.
All right. We got a bunch of Wolves questions here. We'll blow through a couple of these, and then there's one big one really more about their long-term plan that I want to spend some more time on. Down with Goldie says, so here, why don't we do it this way? I'll just answer this one. You answer the next one on these Wolves ones. Down with Goldie says, I have a friend who insists Andrew Wiggins hurts the Wolves because all he can do is score. I'm not sure he's wrong, but as a total homer, I don't want to believe it. Your thoughts? I think hurts is a tough call as an overall player. I mean, his scoring is useful. He's got a true shooting percentage about the league average. He turns it over a relatively small amount. But yes, he does not really assist very much. He does not rebound. He doesn't block shots, get steals. His individual defense is okay. I thought he actually did a pretty decent job guarding Kawhi Leonard in that game. They lost in OT Saturday night. So I think he's okay on the ball, but off the ball is a help guy, an effort guy, not really making the plays. His shooting has improved a lot, which is good. I think defensively, he's not really great, but I think it's more really that he's kind of overrated at this point in time. I mean, I think he can certainly fit in to be a part of an effective team with some of the right pieces around him. And they definitely do not have the right pieces around him right now to help him. So there's some things that he's good at. There's some things that he's bad at. But when you consider his raw points per game, he's averaging 23.3 points right now. He's about as bad as you can be while still averaging 23.3 points.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of putting it. And that ties in with the other question, which is from Grooms 512. Has your long-term projection changed for Wiggins based on his recent play? What can be reasonably expected for he and Towns to add to their tool belt come next season? What has changed for me? I was looking through his stats for the last little while. So I think I was using, you can, it's hard to kind of pick an exact point with Wiggins where his usage kind of shot up a little bit, but it's a really, really rare combination of things, because he's high usage, but he's not shooting that many threes. He's not getting to the line that much, and he's not assisting or turning over that much. So it's basically, he's taking a lot of shots, but they're going in at a reasonable rate. So that has changed, because it's changed it for me, because you can build a little bit on that. Also, I've seen more from him defensively, which is very, very important in terms of the projection. The most important, there are two things that he can do that would help add to his toolbox in the very near future. One is just getting, even if it's not a like a off the dribble three, just like a reliable set, kind of more set, stable catch and shoot three from anywhere, ideally actually from above the break based on how they use him. And then also being more comfortable with his handle so he can get, so he can, and taking it and getting to the line, let's say one or two more times a game, that would be a massive difference for him in efficiency.
Yeah. His free throws are actually down a little bit
right
this year. And I mean, his jump shot is better. He's shooting 40% on long twos this year, 35% last year, 35% on threes this year, 30% last year. So it seems likely he's become a better shooter, even though that's a small sample. So I think there's some encouraging signs, but yeah, still a lot of the floor game stuff. People are saying it's gotten a little better lately. I haven't seen that much of that. We'll see. And then this is from Large Ticket. I wanted to answer this one just because there's something funny about it. It says, what more could Karl Towns do to warrant discussion for all NBA in your guys' eyes? There's a couple of things. Number one is just play at center all the time and be a center rather than a forward. I think he really plays more power forward with Jang, but plays plenty of center too. I would feel comfortable putting him as a center. And then someone commented under the question, like basically a quote for me saying, I don't know, actually play some defense, chuckle. And that guy just nailed my response. That's exactly what I would have said.
I'm a little bit bitter because your response was spot on and mine actually had an inaccuracy because he's not like last in DRPM or anything like that. He's, you know, he's a little bit lower than most centers. But yeah, I mean, defense is where he can really make that difference. So what I wanted to kind of talk about with you with that is right now, if we were to classify both of them as centers, and that gets a little bit complicated. The case for Towns, especially over the last couple weeks, I think the case for Towns is stronger than the case for DeMarcus Cousins. It's a close call between the two of them. And then you could throw Jokic in the mix if you really wanted to. But Towns moving above Cousins, if you agree with that premise, that's a pretty massive development for him in terms of this long term.
Cousins has missed some games. Towns is more efficient. I think he spaces the floor for his teammates more. He actually has like less shooting, I think, around him in a lot of ways. He's not as bad defensively as Cousins has been this year. The Wolves actually have defended respectively since the first month of the season or so, and Cousins teams have not defended respectively at all. But yeah, I mean, he could get a lot better defensively, get into a stance more, be more of a help defender. And I think he would be helped too, just by being played at center more and really developing those help and basket protection instincts, as opposed to having to close out to three-point shooters all the time. All right, so let's get to this one here from Lone Star Sports. What kind of small forward and power forward that's a free agent fits best with this current Wolves roster? Would re-signing LaVine and Wiggins, I guess that would be a year from now, in restricted free agency, adding a lottery pick at either the three or four and some older free agents like PJ Tucker and Taj Gibson be ideal compared to making a massive offer via trade for a star? And let's take stock of really where they are right now first, and maybe you can answer the question, Danny. They basically, if I'm thinking about, you're trying to get to the level of being like a 55 win type of team, which is what they want to, where they want to get to and where maybe they have the talent to get to, you need to get a new one. I don't think Chris Dunn is that guy. He hasn't shown it yet. They need a new two. If you're thinking of LaVine as a sixth man, which I, especially after the injury, I'm probably thinking of him more in that vein. He's not really that good of a defender. So there's definitely some reasons to think that you might want somebody who's lower usage, more of a spot up guy at the two. And then I think they need another starter at the four. Well, Bielitsa has played better as time has gone on this year. They have Jang around. I think he's more really a backup center. I think that their long-term plan, of course, as I've said a billion times, should be Towns with some shooting around him. So the type of, so that's what they need to get. And then their cap situation, they projected $27 million in cap space this year without Shabazz Muhammad, or with Shabazz Muhammad's cap hold. That goes up to around $35 million if they move on from Muhammad. And if they don't sign anybody to long-term money past this year, they could have around $31 million next year if they don't extend Wiggins and LaVine. That's probably not going to happen, either of those things. So this is really their chance now to get something. And then, of course, they're going to have a pick that'll probably be a top 10 pick, but not in the top five.
They're in this spot, you mentioned this, but I think it's an important thing to emphasize, where they have max space, but they can't get more. They're kind of where they are. And so you have to, that means you have to spend incredibly wisely because you can't really create more. And the questioner asked about making a massive offer via trade. I don't think they have the assets, assuming they're going to keep their key pieces. I mean, yeah, of course, if you're going to include Karl Anthony Towns in a trade, you can get just about anybody in the league.
I mean, I don't think Chris Dunn and your first round pick is getting you a superstar this year. That's really your, you'd probably throw Tyus Jones in there or something too, maybe. I don't know.
If they were close enough to getting Jimmy Butler last year with that kind of an offer, they should have pulled the trigger. I mean, straight up. If that was enough then, it's not enough now. So they should have done that if it were possible. We obviously don't know if it were. And I have trouble saying this specific player is a fit. I like to look more at kind of archetypes. So as you said, shooting is incredibly important. And ideally, I think... A good way of saying what they would want is somebody like Paul Millsap, but younger than Paul Millsap, because Millsap's 32 at this point, and that doesn't work really well with where they're going. But Millsap is a strong defensive four who can shoot. So that's really the direction that they want to go. Also, you talked about the idea of needing a two. They could also approach it as wanting Wiggins in the other spot. You can maybe think about those as you get one of either direction. But basically, I think they just need talent, as long as that talent doesn't have significant weaknesses. Like Gordon Hayward would be a nice fit for them because he can do a lot of things offensively. Oh, of course not. He's not going there. But that's kind of the idea of like who would fit in well. You're looking more in that direction. And they also, considering they don't really have, you know, they don't have a Ben Simmons on their roster, you also should try to get somebody who can handle the ball. And that is harder to get this year, probably in free agency, than in recent years. But that might be, you know, hopefully, I'm sure they think it's Chris Dunn or Tyus Jones or Rubio, but it's going to be tough.
I would normally be averse to them spending a bunch of money on older veterans, but they just need some guys who can be role players on this team. And this is a situation where it's use it or lose it, as long as they aren't going to sign like 4-year contracts for some of these guys. But I think JJ Redick would be someone that they could go after with a big offer, or Kyle Korver, maybe a smaller offer than that. CJ Miles, I think, would be a decent fit. I love Omri Caspi, but considering they weren't even willing to claim him off of waivers, they clearly don't agree. Taj Gibson would be terrible there because he can't shoot, and he's probably going to want more money and is going to want to go to a contender. At point guard, I think George Hill or Jrue Holiday, I mean, a big offer for one of those two guys, depending on what the market is. But I wouldn't want to outbid Utah for George Hill necessarily. Holiday is young enough, 27, that he might make some sense. But they need some guys who can make spot up shots and defend. I think you just go with the assumption that Wiggins and Towns and then LaVine, if he can get healthy again, will be the guys who are going to be the main shot creators for you. And then around them, guys who can shoot, guys who can defend. Those are the type of players that I'm looking for. And of course, such players are quite valuable because there aren't a lot of those guys. And, you know, it's funny, a lot of kind of the old school guys in the NBA don't really like paying for those guys because they kind of view it as like, oh, like all this guy can do is shoot threes on offense, and they don't really have as much respect for that unless he's just like an unbelievable shooter. But if you can do that and defend your position, you just fit in so well, and this team just desperately needs some role players. All right, let's move on to something that is not the Minnesota Timberwolves, from Benny Gann. After seeing Jaylen Brown and Brandon Ingram for nearly 60 games now, which player do you think turns out better?
We disagreed before the draft. I was higher on Ingram. I wasn't completely sold on Brown defensively. I didn't love his handle as much as you did. I have come around. Ingram certainly has potential. I'm not writing him off, though I do think his best spot is as a role player on a good team. Jaylen Brown just has a little bit higher of a functional ceiling. Like Brandon Ingram probably has a higher absolute ceiling, but I'm right now, I think it's more likely that Brown becomes a higher functional player. I'm liking his defense and instincts a little bit better. We watched him in the Twitter NBA show Second Screen. I like his judgment is getting there, and I don't see anything really broken with him, which is something that concerned me a little bit at Cal.
Yeah, his shooting has been good, both from the foul line. He's shooting better than he had in college. 33% on threes, not bad for a rookie. Mostly open attempts, but nonetheless, not too bad. 50% on two-pointers. Ingram, the shooting struggles are the big issue for him, I would say. Brown getting to the line a fair amount for a role player. I've been impressed with his defense. I've been impressed that he's been able to contribute to winning basketball on a good team, especially playing some as a small ball four. I think that's really helped the Celtics slot, we haven't seen the stuff from him that got me so excited, which was doing stuff off the dribble, really, other than in small bursts, doing stuff in transition. But the fact that he's been able to, his defense is way ahead of where I thought it would be, especially seeing him earlier in the year. So the fact that he's been able to play winning basketball now, and that I still feel he has that upside to do stuff with the ball in his hands and create plays, I feel pretty good about him. He is a year older than Ingram. Ingram does have a lot of low-hanging fruit in his game just by getting stronger. He has improved. He has gotten stronger going to the basket throughout the year. But I mean, the record of any player in the NBA having a season like his, under 30% from three and 40% on twos, and just extremely inefficient. He does show the flashes in the pick and roll, getting to the rim with his length every once in a while. But overall, the track record of players with this kind of statistical performance, even as young as he is, he's one of the younger players that we've had since the draft rule changed to not allow high schoolers in. Yeah, I mean, Jaylen Brown has been effective this year. Brandon Ingram has not. And, you know, that's the biggest difference in my mind. And I felt then, that way before the draft, so that's still part of it too.
Yeah, and that still is a part of the evaluation. It's just that we have more information to stack on top of it. MM825, if you were the Brooklyn Nets, in what order would you pursue these restricted free agents, considering price, talent, likelihood of match? Nerlens Noel, KCP, Otto Porter, Tim Hardaway Jr. So I classify them in two different groups. Two are players that I feel their team is going to match no matter what, KCP and Otto Porter. So they go to the back.
Those guys are probably, I would anticipate that those guys will just re-sign contracts with their old team.
Yeah, certainly possible. No real thing to be gained there unless something really crazy goes wrong. But yeah.
Unless you're just doing an agent a favor.
Yeah, if you have your money a week and a half in, sure. No problem with it. I feel comfortable with it. I then prioritize Nerlens over Hardaway. Of course, price depends on that because I think Nerlens is a way better player. And if he works out, it is a more valuable thing to have. He's done pretty well since he's been in Dallas. And I just don't see it with Hardaway in that way. However, if the price is low enough that you feel comfortable, if it's not like an Allen Crabbe offer sheet, why the heck not? Because that means the Hawks aren't that interested in him. That means the market's a little bit tepid, and he can be a useful player, as I think of him as more of a sixth or seventh man than a fourth or fifth starter. But there is still a value to that for a guy who can put the ball in the hoop.
Yeah, with Hardaway, you would want to be paying him like a bench guy. I think I don't know whether he'll come through, but their plan is going to be for Caris LeVert probably to start at the two going forward. He's been their one guy really of this rebuilding that's looked like he has some potential to even be a starting level player at this point. So, and it could be that Atlanta is not really interested in paying Hardaway. They've already got Kent Bazemore, who they're paying a bunch of money to. There was talk that they might be trying to move Hardaway at the deadline for 2 second round picks. That didn't happen. So it doesn't seem like, it seems like he might be gettable, but is he going to want to sign for kind of backup money? Maybe we'll see. But I wouldn't want to pay. I feel okay. I mean, even like $10 million a year seems like too much for Hardaway, though, doesn't it?
Eight
like
and a half
more
is
than the
mid level
exception. I mean, even the mid level exception seems like a lot to me. I mean, I guess he's young, and they just need to get some more young talent in the pipeline. But even then, I mean, Hardaway can't guard threes.
Nope.
He's a one position defender, and he really doesn't. Other than that one crazy fourth quarter against Houston. He's been a rotation player. I think I don't see him maturing into a starter. So how much is that guy worth in this new economy, especially with the cap being flat? Yeah, you know, 7, 8, 9 million a year, something like that. But the nature of restricted free agency is either you have to overpay so the team doesn't match, or he just doesn't get an offer at all. And I wouldn't want to overpay for him. He doesn't have the upside.
No, he's not even out like close to Allen Crabbe for me.
Rudolph Gobert, and I can just take this one on my own here because it's a pretty simple answer. Can you talk about how or why defenses don't affect opponent three-point shooting that much? People don't believe it. And because it's proven that defenses don't affect opponent three-point shooting in terms of the percentage. The way that you defend the three-point line is you don't let them get shots off. There's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the biggest idea, there's two of them really. One idea of how like you could affect opponent three-point percentage. One is, they're making sure that the right guys are taking them. Well, clearly that's information that you could prove that if that were out there, that certain teams make worse three-point shooters take all the three-pointers, and that just has not been proven. That proof is not out there. It's not true. The second component of it is that they do a better job of contesting three-pointers. But the nature of three-pointers is it's still a very difficult shot to make from that far away. I mean, some guys have a very quick release, but not that many. It's a shot that generally, more so than any other shot in the NBA, is taken when you're wide open or when you're at least open. Maybe down at the end of the clock every once in a while, you'll have to take a tough one. But coaches don't want guys taking really tough three-pointers. And so that's where you see the difference come in, because you're preventing the three-point shot from ever going up if you're close enough to affect it. If the guy can get the shot off, then you're probably not close enough to affect it in all but a few cases.
Yeah, I think that's a good distillation of kind of the issue at hand. We have a couple different questions relating to LeBron and the Cavs, so we can kind of do those together as well. So we'll start it with Point Accounting 2. LeBron's advanced defensive stats have been very good since returning to Cleveland. Do the memorable plays where he slacks off overshadow his smart defense and imposing presence? It's not like his good stats are the result of him just being on a team with good defense. There's a difference between, you know, like he hasn't been an elite defender or anything like that with those stats. He's been solid, but it's, I think, the issue of why people are reluctant to praise his regular season defense is that we know his playoff defense is so much better.
Well, let me push back on that, actually, because I don't even know that his playoff defense has been that good, except for really last year in the finals, to be honest.
It was quite good last year in the finals, though.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he still maybe has that, but I didn't think that he was like, I mean, I think he was fine. He definitely, but it's not like he's guarding like the opponent's best player or anything. And certainly putting him on Draymond Green changed that series. The blocks that he had, you know, those were ridiculous plays that very few others can make. But anyway, so I want to say I haven't been as impressed overall in the playoffs as you have. Maybe we're overrating one series a little bit too much.
That could be true. But also, you know, like the other reason is because I think we see it and we see his effort. And he's such a bellwether defensively for them as a team that it all fits together. And the Cavs have been disappointing this year on defense. So I think it's fair to give him some of that blame, because this isn't, you know, they don't have that defensive centerpiece on the interior. Tristan's not bad, but he's not that guy.
Yeah, his defensive RPM this year, I don't think, is actually that good. Also, remember that they always are terrible when he's off the floor. And so it's not only about him. I mean, I think he's fine defensively still, despite the lapses. But then they have nobody else who's a good defensive small forward coming in behind him on a lot of these teams. And also the things that were mentioned, like opponent field goal percentage, I hope he doesn't mean this opponent field goal percentage when someone is taking a shot within a certain distance of him. That is really an incredibly flawed stat. Opponent field goal percentage when you're defending the rim, that's a little different. That is not a flawed stat. But just like there really is not the sample. He doesn't guard the good players on the other team usually. So there's a lot of reasons why, for anybody, that if you're saying, hey, players shoot X when LeBron is in the vicinity, that's not a good stat to be using. So anybody who's using that, don't use that. Tenny Ram, he comments all the time, so I think it's actually Tanira M, coming to think of it, but hopefully I'm getting that right. Please correct me on Periscope or the next mailbag if I'm messing that up. He asked this question on the Twitter NBA show Second Screen on Wednesday. We said we were going to answer it and then we forgot to. Should the Cavs be worried about their defense in the playoffs?
In the finals, yes. Before that, no, because they're not going to need it. They're so good offensively. As long as they're at full strength or close to it, they can outscore everybody, especially with no team in the East putting it together on both sides. Boston's defense hasn't been what we expected. Toronto's defense hasn't been good, unless one of those teams really figures out the other end. And Toronto probably has the best chance of that just because they changed their personnel, but they're not going to have a chance to put it together until the playoffs themselves.
All right, we got some more cool questions here, but first this from Indochino. Indochino is the best fitting suit that I've ever owned. They are a custom menswear brand that is far, far less expensive than the old school ways of doing that. When I was a lawyer, I got this suit that was custom made. It was well over $1,000. Fit me pretty well, better than Off the Rack, but not as good actually as Indochino. If you want to get measured, you can go into one of their 9 North American showrooms, or you can actually do it all online. They have a 14-step measurement process. They teach you how to take 14 different measurements. I have friends who have done it that way. I actually went into the showroom. All of them say that it fits really well. The other thing about Indochino is you can customize it. No more off the rack. Hey, let me find the best one. Oh, you like that one? Nope, sorry. It's only in like a 57 short. at Indochino, any pattern that's available on their site, you can customize the lapels, the jacket linings, pleats on the pants, the angle of the pockets. And you do all that, you submit your body measurements. They also do dress shirts as well that fit great. I've got a couple of those. Kick back, relax, get ready to step into the best, most stylish suit you've ever worn in just 4 weeks. Of course, it wouldn't be a Dunked On ad if we didn't have a promo code, Capspace code this time. You can enter it to get any premium Indochino suit for just $389 at Indochino.com. And of course, shipping is free. So it's Indochino.com, promo code Capspace for any premium suit, just $389. And of course, free shipping. Get ready to look like $1 million at Indochino.com, promo code Capspace. What's up next here?
Let's go with Dietz 241. Question is, a number of point guards have turned into stars relatively late in their careers after initially seeming like average to below average pros. They gave Lowry, Mike Conley, Kemba Walker, Goran Dragic as examples, and asked, who from the current group of point guards in their early 20s strikes you as having the potential to make a leap similar to those? And the players they listed were Marcus Smart, Dante Exum, Manuel Mudiay, and Elfrid Payton.
Well, Lowry, Conley, Kemba, Goran Dragic. What is the common thread in why they got good? Well, they all learned how to shoot. And Lowry especially, he couldn't make threes even in college to save his life. And for the first couple of years of his career, Conley, not known as a shooter. Kemba, his shooting has completely revolutionized his career the last 2 years. Same thing with Dragic, although Dragic was always awesome at getting to the basket. His first couple of years, he couldn't make shots. So any of those guys, really, I would say that if I had to pick from those four guys, Mudiay would be the one I'd feel most positively about. I think the big problem for Mudiay right now is actually his defense. I think that's the biggest reason why he's not playing for them. And Smart, I think, just isn't quite athletic enough. I don't believe in his ability to shoot jumpers off the dribble. I think just his form is kind of weird. Payton, his free throw shooting was always bad too. At least I think all those guys that were listed before were always pretty good free throw shooters. Payton was not a good free throw shooter for a long time, so I think there's a little bit more of an issue there. Exum, just kind of too early to tell with him. His shooting has been bad. He's coming back from the ACL. He's looked a little bit more explosive. He's got the vision. Anyone else that we really should talk about in that type of discussion at this point?
Well, I guess
Chris Dunn.
I want to talk another thing that Mudiay has on these other players is I think that he's better as a passer and has better court vision than them. So that means that a smaller increase in shooting will make a larger difference.
Yeah, I don't know if he's a better passer than Exum, actually. I think Exum throws some wow passes and will once he starts to attack more. But but I think Exum and Mudiay having the size, too, I think really helps a lot if they can learn to shoot.
I'd love for it to be Marcus Smart. I'm a big fan of his. But also, I don't think he's that's his role, is to be that guy who runs an offense. He's such a good
defender.
But
all those guys, except even Payton to some degree, they're a little bigger than some of the guys that were mentioned. Those guys are actually two position defenders. So you don't have to get as good offensively when you have the defensive potential if they could actually come through there. I'm looking at who else might fall into that category now as guys who could get a lot better. You might have said Reggie Jackson up until this year. And then, of course, he's really, maybe you could say Jerry and Grant, although he's already 24. He's just quietly is shooting the ball a little bit better this year.
Schroeder
would be the last one. Yeah, that's right.
Bledsoe's a little too old, right? Like, I mean,
he's already 27, so yeah. I mean, you tell me which one of those guys learns how to shoot well, I'll tell you who's going to be really good. And I don't really know how to determine that, to be honest, other than just looking at their free throw shooting and their form a little bit. I would say a lot of them have like pretty flawed looking jumpers at this point. So I'm not really sure who it would be. Mudiay would still be, I'd have the most hope for him out of any of those players, though, I think.
Another question from Porn Accounting 2. I think it's the second question from them. How is the Spurs bench so good despite not having any six man of the year candidates? They have an amazing rating and all that kind of stuff. There are two different answers to this. One is Patty Mills is deserving of consideration, but I think that the top two guys are just so far ahead of everyone else that I always feel bad saying somebody is worthy of, like, you know, of an honorable mention when I don't think you can make a credible argument for them to win. So that's why for me it's
I think Andre even is probably, I mean, we talked about him yesterday, and I'm giving him short shrift just due to no fault of his own, just because like Kevin Durant was on this team this year and there just hasn't been as much attention on the Warriors. I think Iguodala is definitely, it should be in this discussion still, and he's going to play more minutes now with Durant checked out, so maybe he can boost his candidacy, but he's not going to win, obviously, with the way Williams and Gordon have scored.
But people don't talk about the Spurs bench because it's so consistently good. Usually we're more intrigued by things that are new, that are surprising, and they've produced also the talent level on their bench is better than a vast majority of teams. You and I both love Dwayne Dedmon. He is starting, you know, fair enough for them now, but Dedmon is better than most bench players other teams. Patty Mills is better than almost every other bench player in the league. And then the other players, they get them and put them in a good spot to succeed. Davis Bertans is a good example of this. Simmons working him in slowly. A lot of those different guys, they know what to do. And they have Manu Ginobili. I mean, come on now.
Yeah, that helps a lot too. And they also, when Kawhi and Aldridge are out of the game, they move the ball more. What they've gotten out of David Lee defensively, who is in much better shape than the last couple of years, has really been outstanding. But I think it's mostly coaching. I mean, that's all it is. Because, and frankly, the Spurs bench killed all year. And then when they actually played a good team in the playoffs last year, and I think even against the Clippers the year before, who never had a great bench, they really were nowhere near as effective as in the regular season. So I think a lot of it is just Pop getting these guys to execute. They never make a defensive mistake. They also mix in some of their starters at the start of the second quarter, which I think helps them too, which is usually when the other team is playing their worst lineup. So that's about it. Let's move on, though.
Lamar Matic, could there soon be a point where even the best low post scorers with questionable defensive upside won't be drafted in the lottery? I don't think we need to go through the full question, but they kind of invoke Jahlil Okafor as an example of this. And
yeah, so questionable defensive upside is interesting, right? Like, is it questionable defensive upside or is it no defensive upside? Because I would actually say Jahlil has a 7'5 wingspan and pretty quick feet, and he's strong. Like, it's not, he actually has physical tools that I would put, you know, around the median, I would say, of most NBA centers at this point, maybe slightly below.
Yeah, I think I remember you and Mike Schmitz talking about that on a draft preview pod.
Right. Yeah, and he actually can get a few blocks every once in a while. I mean, the big problem to me, I mean, all right, number one, he's had this knee injury that still apparently is lingering up to a year later. He had some issues for what was supposed to be a small meniscus trim. And he also just isn't in good shape. And he actually, that viral video of him kind of standing around, he actually talked about that video amazingly. It's funny to hear that. And he said, hey, you know what, my instructions were to drop on that play, and you know, I haven't played that many minutes consecutively. I just was 7 or 8 minutes into, like, you know, a 10-minute stint, and I hadn't played the whole first quarter, basically. And yeah, you know, I was a little tired on that play, and I think it's surprising me. I applaud him for his honesty there, but yeah, I mean, he's going to have to get into better shape. Hopefully he can use this last stint of the season with him beat out to do that. And so, I mean, I think Jahlil Okafor, someone like him coming out of college, he is a cautionary tale. We've seen that guys who can't, I mean, Jonas Valanciunas, even his star has fallen quite a bit, even from last year's playoffs at this point. Another kind of offense only big man with some length, but pretty slow. And his cancer really has settled in more as a bench guy now. So I'm thinking, like, kind of lower end of the top 10, where you're feeling, all right, this guy could be really good offensively, but if he turns into more of a sixth man type of guy, a cancer type of guy, we're okay with that. If maybe he doesn't end up being a starter, as opposed to where if you draft a number three and he's not a starter, you're very disappointed.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add on top of that is that there usually aren't 10 surefire starters in a draft class.
Yeah.
So
no, that's and certainly to know who they are, especially. So sorry for hijacking that one, but I thought the way the question was asked, we kind of had to dig in right there. Let's see here. This will be a good one. I wanted to hear your take on this. I have some thoughts, but I'll let you go first. Papa Barnes 10. Adam Silver recently said at the Sloan Conference, which I was at, that there will probably be changes coming to the All-Star game. What changes would you guys like to see the most?
I feel that there is too much of an emphasis on the game. And the fundamental difference between baseball and all of the other sports is that you can play a baseball game at functionally half speed and it's the same. Whereas in basketball, these guys are not getting paid. It's putting on a show for the fans. And this is a very different world than when Michael Jordan and all the other guys really cared, because these players are businesses now. That was another thing that came out of the Sloan Conference, was Bob Myers bringing up that there are two players on the Warriors who make more from their shoe deals than they do from playing for the Warriors. And while I would love to see 10 10 guys who really cared go at it, I think that's fundamentally unrealistic. The way that I would do it if they had to, if they said the game is a mandatory part of this, is the idea of picking teams, because that could just create the animosity and you could get some of those natural rivalries. So the players are eligible based on, you know, the voting in actually a very similar way, but then they're team captains, something of that ilk, and they choose. Also, maybe tightening up the format, you know, I don't know exactly what the timing would be, but making it a little bit less reflective of an NBA game, 10 minute quarters, maybe even do like halves, like 15 minute halves, and just make it work that way.
Yeah, you have to make it more competitive. And what something that the guys have said is essentially that we will play hard, like at the end, if it's close, maybe. So my idea was, what if they just played a series of 7 7-minute games? So that would be 49 minutes. You're not allowed to sub during those 7 minutes. And maybe you wouldn't even have, maybe you could even say, hey, we're going to have no commercials during this 7 minutes. That would be kind of cool, right? And so you would get down to, and then you would get like, each team would get like a point if you won like one of those 7 minute games, and then maybe the last one could be worth 3 in case like one team was kind of blowing the other one out. One team could get back in it and win it at the end. And so knowing that guys can't get subbed out, that they might only play 2 of these 7 games, maybe that'd be like, hey, and that's all you're gonna play. Maybe you could get guys to go hard, because then it's close, presumably at the end of that 7 minute game, and you're actually like fighting to win it. Maybe that could be it.
It's interesting. Format would be kind of more like an MMA fight, which I think totally makes sense in terms of the way that they would care. And also, you could actually combine those two ideas together, where you had a LeBron type for each team who had more control over what combinations the players were in, which would actually be a fun thing. Like, kind of, I went to the President's Cup one year, and for the day of singles competition, when they have to choose and post the matchups, that's one of the more interesting parts of it. So seeing, you know, whether they put like, whether one team gets a bunch of guys from the same team and they put like the Warriors guys versus the Cavs guys or whatever else like that would be really fun.
All right, let's do a new thing here for a couple of these. I'm going to pick one. I'm going to put 30 seconds on the timer and you answer it as quickly as possible. All right, so
sure.
Let's see here. What's a good one for you? Dangerous liberal. Should the Raptors trade Jonas Valanciunas? If so, what do you think will be the haul for him? Go.
They should consider moving him, but you don't want to just treat it as unloading, because what you're doing is saving ownership money. I think the haul for him is going to be like a young player of some interest, but not a ton of interest, and salary filler. I think that's really about it.
Yeah, with 12 seconds left here, I'm not sure what team needs him. He's making little enough that maybe he could be a bench guy, but again, not really that enticing of an asset. Maybe you could just get another wing for him, but probably not. All right.
You one. From Marcus Zors, would you feel safe offering the full 5-year max to players like Millsap, Lowry, or CP3?
Paul, I mean, safe, what does safe mean? Like, safe means that it's not going to be a bad contract? No, those are absolutely going to be bad contracts. Would I do it? For the Raptors, depends where I am this year. For the Clippers, I almost certainly would. Paul is still playing like a max player right now. You probably get at least 2 years of decent value, and then he hopefully won't be a totally dead player by the end of that. Millsap, absolutely not. No way. Is for where the Hawks are right now as a franchise. All right, what can I get you here?
Can I give one to myself?
yeah, absolutely. I was trying to find a good one that you could answer in 30 seconds.
I got one, as I actually thought about this question a lot. From temp_a chill, given the best possible GM in front office, how long would it take to rebuild the Kings? Related, should Vivek fire Vlade and hire Hinkie? First part's more important. I would put it, unless they hit the jackpot, at 3 to 4 years, because they also don't have their own first round pick in 2019. It's hard for them to get free agents. I think that it will take that long to really turn it over. If Sam Hinkie would take the job, he would be a great fit to just go to do the full rebuild that they need. However, I don't think he would take that job considering the precedent that's there.
I will. Yeah, I think he wants to go somewhere where there's stable ownership. And also, I don't know that they have anyone on their team right now that I would look at as like a surefire starter. Even when you're starting from that level, maybe one of these young guys will turn into a starter level player. You're starting from that level. They are going to have plenty of cap space, but no one's going to want to sign there. Maybe they could get like one starter in free agency. Like, to get to being like, if we're going to say the rebuild's over when they are a playoff team again, 2021, 2022, maybe, if you hit on some of these draft picks.
They don't even have that many clear-cut backup guys. I mean, they have a couple of positions where they have multiple multiple players for the same spot, like center, but they don't have like a power forward of the future or a shooting guard of the, or a small, sorry, small forward of the future. They don't have any guys there.
Yeah, we exceeded our 30-second time limit.
Barely.
But
hopefully.
No, it was by like 45 seconds, but it was necessary because we had to discuss what dire straits the Kings are, and you can't do that in a mere 30 seconds.
That's true.
Triple overtime, 76-93. Solid Suns reference there, referring to the finals games they played in triple overtimes in 76 and 93, I would assume. What do you think the Suns will do with Alex Len and Big Sauce? I assume that's Alan Williams.
It is.
How much money do you think they'll get? Also, how about the play of Big Sauce and Tyler Ulis the last few games? Exclamation point.
Yeah, I mean, Ulis had a crazy shot today to win the game. That was remarkable. And I think that they're going to let the market play out for Alex Len. I don't think he's going to sign before the moratorium ends. And Alan Williams might end up being the same way, where they just kind of see where the market goes. That's the benefit of having match rights. I've enjoyed Alan Williams and Tyler Ulis a lot more than Alex Len so far this year. I think Ulis is a rotation player moving forward, maybe even really soon.
Yeah, Len, I wouldn't want to pay more than maybe Myers Leonard. I think he is trending towards a career backup. That might even be too much. And then Williams, I could see him kind of like the Tarik Black contract. It would be about what he would get. He's a restricted free agent, Arenas Limited, but Arenas probably won't come into play. The most he could get in an offer sheet starting for another team would be the mid-level exception, which will be $8.4 million this year. Okay, this we're taking the 30-second limit off for this one. Doc the GM, what did you actually say when Seth Partnow, a friend of the show, claimed you said a tuna sandwich is a dessert? Well, we went out to dinner at Fogo de Chao last night with a few other analytics luminaries and Seth. Bill Barnwell was there too. And so Fogo de Chao is like this all-you-can-eat Brazilian restaurant. And at the end of the meal, we ordered a dessert, and it was this chocolate lava cake. And if I were having a chocolate lava cake at home or anything chocolate, I would have a glass of milk. And so naturally, I ordered a glass of milk. Why would you do it any differently in a restaurant than you would at home? And as it turned out, the chocolate lava cake was a little bit dry, and I was quite happy to have that milk as Seth and Bill struggled to get their lava cake down without any sort of fluid involved. Nonetheless, Seth and Bill both thought it was completely ridiculous that I had ordered a milk in a restaurant, and they asked our waitress, who was relatively new, how many people ordered milk in a restaurant. And she was like, oh, no, it makes perfect sense to order milk. And then, of course, being the analytics guys that they are, they drilled down to exactly how many people have ordered a milk in a restaurant. And during the time you've worked here, she said, well, I've worked here for 3 months and no one has ordered one.
You're just off on guard. I fully support you on that part of the story.
Well, and so then, but then Seth, and so I was like, yeah, I love milk. There are certain things that I won't eat without milk. Chocolate is certainly one. A peanut butter jelly and jelly sandwich is another. And I said, yeah, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is basically like dessert, especially if you're an adult. It's just all carbs and like jelly, which is basically just sugar, and peanut butter, which has a bunch of sugar in it probably too, because I'm not down with like that natural peanut butter crap. And then I was like, oh, and another food that I won't eat without milk is a tuna fish sandwich, because the tuna is kind of a little bit dry. It's nice to have the milk with it. And so Seth then extrapolated that in his tweet to say that I was arguing that peanut butter and jelly and tuna fish were desserts, and that of course was not what I was saying. And so thank you, Doc the GM. This is actually a real question, by the way. I didn't make this up for myself. This is not Date Nunkin who's asking this, for giving me the chance to defend my honor in that regard.
I will also note that there are a lot of foods that are really closer to desserts. Like, there are some versions of French toast that are closer to dessert than to a breakfast food, but that's also kind of what brunch food is. So
let me take this one too. What have been my biggest overall takeaways from the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference? Does every NBA team send a representative? I mean, it's not like this idea that, oh, they're not sending a representative. Oh my God, like they must be behind the times. I mean, I think it's not like you can't do your job if you're not coming to something like this. It's just more shows what you're interested in. It's really, for me at this point, it's been, I enjoy the presentations, but I find it easier to just read the research papers and try and learn something. A lot of the presentations, I actually went to a few from other sports. Like, I went to one about like how baseball arbitration works. I went to one by Pro Football Focus where they explained what their methods are. But my biggest takeaway actually is that a lot of young people could use a little bit of advice on how to network. I had a few people who recognized me and came up to me and said hello, and I was very flattered by that. And so they would come up and they'd say, hey, you know, big fan of the show. And I would say that, and you know, usually I'm always like interested to meet people. My thought is that I'll usually ask them about them and kind of what their goals are. And if I have anything useful to say for them, I'll say it. But I would say if you're going to go up to network with someone, you know, find something that you can talk about that where it's not going to be, oh, hey, big fan. And then there's kind of, you have nowhere to go after that. Like come up with something where you can say, oh, you know, what do you think about this? Or, you know, I was thinking this, like, this is my theory. What do you think about that? You know, something where we could just kind of talk basketball or talk about something where it's not just like, oh, hey, yeah. All right. Now, what could we talk about after these three sentences? It's not like that annoys me, but if you really, because really, if you think about it, and this is true, not that like I can really do anything for anybody or like I should be someone that people are trying to impress, but certainly there are people who work for teams that you might be trying to impress, for example. And so if you're going to do that, be able to have a conversation about your field. Like that's what these networking conferences are for. Whatever your field is discussing your field. So try to bring up something. If you have an opinion you think is good or a question that you wanted to know or something like that, just like everyone's always happy to have a conversation about something like that. It's just kind of the like, well, it's really nice to hear from people that, you know, respect your work a lot. It's tough to like make a conversation out of somebody saying that.
Right. I can actually bring up a direct example of this. So I went to the Sports Innovation Conference, the Stanford kind of, it's not a rival. They're very different things for Sloan. And I had actually never met Henry Abbott. And so I introduced myself and we talked for a second. Then we started talking about, I believe it was kind of the idea of the Warriors' new arena and the role of ownership and things like that. And it was, you want to have that other thing because some people do really enjoy talking about themselves and their work. And they can, you know, that lead in the, oh, I'm a big fan of yours can be a 5-minute conversation. But you want to have something in your back pocket because A, that's not necessarily a conversation that makes you memorable to them. And because sometimes, particularly with the two of us, incidentally, that conversation doesn't always fly. So you have something else that can be more of a real conversation starter. You can use the other point as an icebreaker, but another way into a more substantive conversation.
And I should say this too, like I respect anyone who's willing to go up to someone that they don't know and try to start a conversation. I mean, absolutely. whether it's a girl in a bar, whether it's someone whose work you respect, whatever it is, it's difficult. I mean, I first started coming to these conferences when I was 32. And so a lot of people who might listen to this podcast are trying to learn how to network and have conversations. They're going to be a lot younger than that. I mean, I was used to doing this in the legal field. You know, you're a more experienced person. You're a more experienced conversationalist at 32 than you are at 22. So anyone who comes up and says hello and, you know, I respect people having the courage to do that. But if you do it in a smart way and just, I mean, and even like, the other thing about networking too is the first time that you meet someone, it's very rare that you know you're necessarily going to make a connection, right? Like if you meet in the hallway at Sloan or something, you know, 5 minutes, maybe 10 is really the longest that you should feel comfortable like having a conversation because, you know, they got other people that they know that they want to talk to. I mean, that's probably as long as I would go. But, you know, you have that conversation. Maybe you can like send the person an email or a tweet saying, hey, it was great to meet you. You know, this is a reminder of who I was. And then you hope to run into them again. And then you could say hello again. You remember the conversation that you had. That's kind of how you start building relationships is over time. It's really to expect, unless the person says specifically, yes, I am like looking to hire someone, please come and talk to me right now. You know, expecting someone to like do something for you or something after like a 5-minute conversation, like that might be a little bit much to expect. So you have to just build relationships slowly over time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right, that was a lot longer than I wanted to spend on that, but hopefully people thought that to be useful advice. And I'm sure there are people who are like professional networks and have written networkers and have written books about this stuff that know a lot more about it than me. But those are some of the philosophies that I've found to be successful because I very well remember the time when nobody knew who the hell I was and I had. I mean, the other thing too that you really helps is if you just have like a site, you have some sort of work that you've been doing in the field that you can talk about a little bit and say, oh, you know, I wrote about this, like, you know, this was, and you know, it's not even like, hey, read this now, please. You know, a lot of people are busy. They may not even have time to do that. But you can say, hey, you know, I wrote an article about this. This is what I found. Like, what do you think of that? You know, you can more even bring it up in conversation while at the same time weaving in the fact that, yeah, I have actually done some work in this field. All right. Now that's enough. should we go to do we have any other ones before the big finish that you really wanted to hit? I guess there are a couple ones, right? This one here from Rohirrim AFC 94. Are triple doubles really all that impressive? People in the 60s didn't think averaging a triple double on a 538, I assume that was the winning percentage of the Cincinnati Royals that year, 1962, was impressive enough to warrant the MVP award. So why would it warrant the MVP award now?
It doesn't have to be impressive. I don't like the idea of arbitrary cutoffs, and there are certain circumstances where a triple double, you know, it's better to have 25, 12, and 8 than to have 18, 10, and 10. So sometimes that can run into it. However, there are also many times where a triple double was integral to your team winning. The games where Nikola Jokic gets a triple double, his team wins a lot of those games because that means he's being active on the defensive glass. It means he's having the ball in his hands a lot. There is a stat, I think Royce Young had it, where with Russell Westbrook, they're overwhelmingly positive when he gets a triple-double and less so when he's not. Also, some of that relates to playing time and a couple other things. The other reason why is because the pace of play is really different now. So averaging a triple-double, now you're getting fewer opportunities to do it, especially because guys are missing fewer shots.
Yeah, you know, and playing way less minutes now. So right. Russ is averaging, what, like 35 minutes a game or something?
Something in that realm. So it's a different sort of accomplishment than it was then in terms of opportunities, in terms of maximizing it. And also because we've talked about this with Russell Westbrook before, his team needs that. He's the best, most productive guy they have after a defensive rebound. He's their best passer. He's their best scorer. So they need all of that for him to win. So while it is not because of the triple doubles, it is a way of reflecting his impact. And it is a way of reflecting his impact that is more accessible to some people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that him getting 8 rebounds a game instead of 10 would really make that big a difference, although it is shown that they do really well when he gets a defensive rebound and pushes the ball, so it's not like he's just entirely stat padding. I think it makes sense to let him get those rebounds. But yeah, I mean, he was my pick for MVP. I think he was yours too. I don't give a shit about him having a triple double. I give a shit about the fact that there's nobody else on this team who can shoot the ball, and he's still putting up these stats, and they've been efficient offensively when he's been on the floor. They fall apart when he's not on the floor, and he's helping his team win games. Like, I think he has contributed the most to his team winning games of any player this year, and that's reflected somewhat in the box score stats, but that's not the only thing, or even, you know, one of the top like 7 things that I would look at. Incidentally, I went back and looked at 61-62. That was the year that Wilt averaged 50 a game. He also did not get the MVP. 51 of the first place votes went to Bill Russell, who was on the Celtics, who were the best regular season team that year. Oscar actually got more first place MVP votes than Wilt, but he got more second and third place votes. And so that was worth noting there, that it was actually Bill Russell. And I mean, there are some bad MVP votes in basketball history lately. I think there have not been many, or not lately, way back in the day there were. Lately, I think there have actually been. It's mostly been pretty decent. But a lot of times it was just, all right, best player on the best team. That's who's going to win it back then. So I wouldn't look at like, and baseball MVP votes were like probably even worse back then.
Yes, they were.
I wouldn't look at what people in the 60s thought to decide like whether something is worthwhile 50 years later.
Last question time?
No. I mean, let's just keep going. I wrote out a bunch of answers here, so I don't want to waste it.
Yeah, that's true.
I think this is the... I've got two more before I have lost
our place, so you will have to take some.
All right, I got it. So this is from the Jayhawk. What is Ben McLemore's ceiling and how can he get there? What team would be the best fit for him to join this summer? I think his ceiling is, I think it's possible he could be a starting 2-guard. He's improved his handle this year. It would really help if he could be a 2-position defender. Probably more likely that would be the 1 and the 2 than the 2 and the 3, because he's just about normal size. And of course, he's got to hit his shots. He's got to become a decent defensive player. I mean, but you know, why? There's, in theory, he could become someone like Danny Green. I don't think his feet are that quick, but you agree with that assessment, Danny?
It would be on the high end of his possibilities to become a starter, but it's far from impossible. And as you said, the handle is a very important part of that, but defense is too, because Yeah. Just a three. Well,
let's put him on a real team and let's see what happens too, you know?
So in terms of teams where he would be a fit, one that I thought of, and I don't think they're going to sign him, is Charlotte. Just put him in
as
there.
As a backup? I mean, they still have Bellinelli and they still have... they still have Batum and Marvin and Kid Gilchrist. I looked at Charlotte and I dismissed them because I felt like they have too much tied up in that position already.
I just don't think they care about any long term any of the guys they have there. So the idea that he could eventually rise into it, and they, it's not a perfect fit because you're looking for a team that has so much at all of the other spots that they can just get a more limited player at the two, and not many of those teams really exist.
Yeah, they still have Lamb as well, who is kind of already fills that role as your like high talent reclamation project with maybe a little bit of upside type of guy. He's got two more years left on his deal. So I would not say that the ones that I thought actually the Wolves he might be okay at as a guy who could just spot up and then maybe be their starting two, but then LaVine would come off the bench and play a lot of the minutes also. If the price were cheap enough. I mean, a lot of it depends on what happens in restricted free agency, whether they give him a qualifying offer. They have so more space than they know what to do with, so they might as well. I mean, maybe they'll just reach an agreement with his agent to let him go, or you know, a sign and trade or something. I mean, I wouldn't want to pay Ben McLemore $10 million a year. I mean, maybe I would give him like, you know, a two-year $20 million deal if I didn't have anything else to spend my money on, just to see whether it would work out. I think the Nets and the Bulls, also teams that could use some shooting, some young talent. The Pacers maybe as well would be another team that is looking for a two guard who can shoot. The Pelicans maybe with their mid-level exception, if they were to bring back Drew Holiday. I think actually he could be okay on the Spurs as maybe Danny Green's eventual replacement as he gets a little bit older. If Manu were to retire, they'll need another shooting guard. Don't know what's going to happen with Jonathan Simmons, although they would probably rather bring him back than McLemore. But you know, that might be the type of guy where they feel like they could really make some strides with him due to his natural talent. Those are the only ones that popped out to me. Should we move on here, or did you want to add anything?
That's fine. From Akon Chago 41, with the Mavericks starting to go younger, which player, either from free agency or the draft, would you like to see fit with the current core of Barnes, Noel, and Curry? So the basic thing, that guy has to be able to shoot, especially when you're going to play with Nerlens Noel. I don't know if Seth Curry is really a part of their core. He's certainly a piece on their team next year. The guy that I thought of, I haven't seen a ton of him this year because he's one that I have backlog of film, Jonathan Isaac. But I don't think their pick is going to be high enough to get him, because Isaac can kind of float between the forward positions. I like his jump shot. He could play with Harrison Barnes. So that would be a decent enough fit there. Yeah, he's a guy that I think stands out, but you need to be able to move the ball and defend. Ideally, switch would be great next to Nerlens.
Yeah, I think they need either a wing or a point guard. I haven't looked at the draft closely enough, but I think a really dynamic point guard who can attack off the dribble. You're going to play Barnes at the four, Noel at the five, probably. They still got Wes Matthews for another couple of years. And Curry, yeah, I mean, he's under contract for one more year. I think of him more as like a solid bench guy, maybe than, you know, a long-term starter. I wanted to hit this one too. League-wide offensive rating is currently the highest in league history on Basketball Reference. Why is this happening, and will it continue?
So yeah, it's a lot of different factors at once, but I think one of the biggest ones is that defense only players can't be on the floor anymore unless they're centers.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point, right? I mean, the new rules, you would think that, oh, playing zone defense, like that helps the defense, right? And teams really started doing that more in the late first decade of the 2000s. I think there is an understanding now that two reasons why zone helps, and I may have said this before, but zone helps the offense, one, because now you can't play guys who can't shoot, right? And two, if you play guys who can shoot, that generally probably negatively correlates with defense among NBA players. If you play guys who can shoot, you can hide them a little bit more defensively as well by sending them more help. Or guys who are just good team defenders, but you know, would just get ISO'd to death back in the old school NBA. So those two things. Then also, I think there's just a renewed ethos on moving the ball, getting the defense going from side to side, taking deeper three-pointers, taking more three-pointers. All of that, I think, adds into it as well. So I think those are the two biggest things, is you can play more shooting on the floor, and there's a feeling that you can't survive offensively without shooting, and you can survive defensively with more limited players in some respects, except maybe at the big positions.
I was thinking of MKG as a good example of this. Like, certainly a capable basketball player, does a lot of things well on the floor, but has a lot of trouble maximizing his value to a team now, whereas 10 years ago, I think a team could have used him really well, and 20 years ago, they really could have.
All right, let's get to the last one here. Barkevius Mimo always has good questions, actually, from my recollection, so please keep those coming, Barkevius. Who is the greatest player who is never the best player on their team?
I'm defining this personally as for a given season. I mean, because if you want to say like a single stretch, then it gets complicated. But there are so many players that would be like considered into this, but then they had like a short stretch where they were the best player. So like for me for that is like Scottie Pippen, you know, like so Scottie right. Pippen had that stretch when MJ retired where he was the best player on his team. He also had some other strong points in his career. So I think that he's invalidated for this. And there are just a lot of guys that are in that ilk that maybe they were the second best player for 90% of their careers, but they don't qualify.
Yeah, Scottie in 93-94. Elgin Baylor was on the Lakers for a year before West, and he probably actually had some years where he was better than West too. In that 61-62 season, he actually got more MVP votes than West did. One that came to mind maybe was, I'm just going to go through the list. I do have one clear answer, but I want to just talk about some of the ones that came to mind for me. Ralph Sampson was one. I think Olajuwon was probably always better than him. But, you know, he was a very good player until the knee injuries failed him. Terry Porter was probably always a little bit behind Clyde Drexler, although because we're also talking about, you know, who is the best player. Tim Hardaway, I don't know if you'd want to say he was better than Mullen.
He's actually my pick for this.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's better than Mullen on some of those teams.
No, he's my pick. I don't think he ever was. And then and then he was on the Miami teams, and he was very, very good on those teams. I didn't go through parse the Miami stats, but off the top of my head.
Alonzo was always better than him on those
teams. That was my thought as well.
Another one who I thought deserves some consideration, and if you have some other ideas for this, I went through my method, actually, if you want to know like a little behind the scenes on like how I'll research this stuff, was I figured that if you were good enough to be in this discussion and still not the best player on your team probably had to make a conference finals. So I went through basically every conference finalist since 1960 just to jog my memory of you know, what some of the teams were and who was on these teams. I thought another one that came to mind for me was Jason Terry on those Mavs teams. I think he's actually a very historically underrated player. And then a few more that I had. James Worthy is a very obvious one. He was never better than Magic. Oh, well, actually, no, I think he still played in 91-92.
I think he did.
And I'm not sure if he actually was the best player on their team at that point, because he fell off really quickly and ended up like he really fell off the map and retired. I don't think he was really that good that year, though. They did at least make the playoffs that year, and they actually almost beat the Suns. The number one seed in the first round is the eighth seed. They won that series, is crazy. They won the first two games in Phoenix in a 5-game series and then lost the last three. Just pretty ridiculous. Rasheed Wallace is another one that came to mind, but he was probably the best player on some of those Portland teams before he went to Detroit.
And that one game on the Atlanta Hawks.
Anybody else who popped to mind for you? Oh, yeah. No, he would have been the best player. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't for an entire season, I guess. But
no, that was for one game. One glorious, glorious game.
Came to mind for you?
Manu Ginobili.
Yes. Yeah, that was one that I had, too. He would certainly be up there. I don't think that he was ever better than Duncan. Maybe he was better than Duncan late, but I don't think he ever was, really. And then Parker probably had some years where he was better than him, too.
You can't give it to them right now, but I would say there might be one or two players on the current Golden State Warriors that will eventually be there.
Yeah, either Draymond or Clay. Yeah. But all of that said, Worthy is in the discussion for me. Another one for me is Amari Stoudemire.
It's a good call.
Now, that's very arguable. I think that the 04-05 season, when he averaged 27 a game, you might have an argument that he was actually better than Nash that year. Probably not, though, when you consider his defense. And then he was definitely the best player on the Knicks for most of the 2010-11 season. And then Carmelo came in, and you could argue that Carmelo was the best guy once he came in at the end of that season. So I don't know how you would want to treat that. But maybe in the discussion here, another one that really stuck out to me is Hall of Famer Sam Jones from the 60s, one of the best shooters shooters of that era. Great player, shot the ball really well, great bank shot from outside. Hall of Fame player, never was better than Russell, and probably wasn't better than Havlicek either towards the end of his career. But my answer was John Stockton.
I feel like there are going to be people that are breaking stuff that, but I don't, you know, this, that era of basketball far better than I. So I'm not objecting to this on my own grounds. I'm just mentioning that I'm sure there are some people who feel that there was at least one season where he was better than Malone.
Yeah. I mean, that's always really tough, right? But it, you know what though, if you asked contemporaries at the time, that pretty much anyone would have said at the time that Malone was better. And I mean, if you look at, like, Malone won two MVPs, I'm guessing Stockton never finished in the top five in MVP voting. That's off the top of my head.
Quick interjection,
but
somebody I just thought of. What about Rodman?
Yeah, I mean, he's not on the level of these other guys. I mean, I think he was a great player, but pretty low end Hall of Famer to me.
That's true. Oh yeah, and it's not greatest career, it's greatest player. So that's more peak than.
And he actually might have had a year with the Pistons where he was the best player.
Yeah, I was trying to think also with the Bad Boys. That's kind of what led me to that. Was I don't, you know, those teams better than I do. I could ask Feldman too about whether Dumars would be kind of in this as well.
Well, you know, I thought of Dumars, but I think he, by the end of Isaiah Thomas's career, I think Dumars was probably better. And as Thomas was really hitting the end, and then maybe even Grant Hill's rookie year, Grant probably took over. I thought of him for sure, but I think there is pretty clearly like a one season stretch there where Dumars was better than Isaiah, because Isaiah really broke down towards the end.
I think another interesting question, and this is for a different podcast, but I'm just saying this because I thought of it off the cuff.
Yeah. By the way, 93-94 Isaiah, that was his last year. I think he tore his Achilles that year, so it would have had to have been Dumars at that point, because Hill didn't come in until the 94 draft.
Right. So my question is this: what players, and this will probably be for a future podcast, but players who were always the best player on their team, like even once they
every year. Yeah.
Like, I think LeBron is there right now.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he wasn't the best
player on his team in the 2011 finals. So he wasn't always the best player.
Well, yeah. I mean, but that,
yeah,
but
no, it was every year. Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
I,
like that just, would be, that would that be, because I don't remember the Jordan Wizards enough to know whether he...
No, he was still the best guy on that team. They didn't have anybody. I mean, they had like a young Richard Hamilton. But
like even Kareem doesn't fit on that list.
Oh, no. No, that would be... You would be very, very hard-pressed to...
Tim Duncan doesn't get on that list.
Something like that, yeah.
Like, it would be very narrow. It might even just be those two guys. Or somebody
Bill Russell. Bill Russell would probably have to qualify.
Probably. Because he retired pretty young too, right?
Wilt, it depends what you think. Like him or Jerry West later on. I don't. Let's. We're spoiling a new mailbag question. Someone ask that one for next time. All right, are we done here?
Yeah. Can I plug a few things?
Indubitably.
So standard Warriors stuff, Warriors Knicks, and then eventually about the Hawks game. Talked with Jared Dubin for Locked On Warriors. Also released the Real Jam Radio with Tim Bontemps doing the tiers, the start of the month, going through everything else. We go into a lot of interesting areas in that. So that'll be on whatever podcast player you're listening to this in. It should have that as well.
For us, don't forget about Twitter NBA Show Second Screen, which will be coming for Spurs Warriors on Saturday, March 11th, 8:30 Eastern time. We'll be doing that. Look for us to tweet that link out or subscribe. Follow me on Periscope, or you can also get an alert when I go with live video. Click on the little bell next to my name on the Twitter mobile app. And we're gonna have five shows this week, so buckle up. We'll touch it later. Don't forget about our sponsors today too. Blinds.com, get that 20% off using promo code CAPSPACE, and same promo code at Indochino will get you any premium Indochino suit for just $389. Talk to y'all tomorrow night.